Hello there, I'm Dominique Saint-Pierre and you're listening to Go Podcast. Today, I'm receiving Chris Shepherd and we are talking about gRPC in Go. Hello, Gophers. So before we dive in with my conversation with Chris, I'd like to remind everyone that, if you want to show your support for this show, if you appreciate what I'm doing, the best way to do that is by buying my courses. So I have a direct link in the show notes. So, I mean, I'm doing everything myself. I'm not getting paid for this podcast. I do all the editing and everything like that. So, I mean, if you want to chip in, that would be appreciated. And on that, this is my conversation with Chris. Hey, Chris Shepherd, thank you very much for accepting this invitation.
No worries, yeah, great to be here, thanks.
Right, so let's start very quick. So I like to ask my first question is something like, you know, can you introduce yourself? But, you know, let's have a small bias towards Go. So, you know, describe yourself, what you are doing and things like that. But, you know, if you can give a little bit background on your Go experience, that would be very nice.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so as you said, I'm Chris Shepherd. I'm a systems engineer based in London, currently working at Cloudflare. At Cloudflare, I primarily work on our audit logs products, which kind of acts as a system of record for customers to see any changes made on their account. And as part of that, we provide like an internal platform to other product teams at Cloudflare, as well as providing functionality for customers to retrieve and view their audit logs. So I've been working at Go for about 6 years now. I actually started my career mainly using Java, but at the time I wanted to kind of, was very keen to explore other things and try other languages. And then once I came across Go, I just really loved the simplicity of it, to be honest. I like how it works without any kind of magic going on, which is kind of a far cry from things like Spring Boot and Java. With those sort of frameworks, yeah, they work really well when they work. But as soon as there's an issue, you end up spending all your day searching Stack Overflow for some very confusing stack trace, and it's really hard to see what happens. Whereas in Go, you don't really have that problem.
Yeah,
kind of very easy to see exactly what the code is doing all the time.
Yeah, that is so true. I mean, I'm coming from a .NET background, and it's crazy the amount of time I was, you know, having to pass on Stack Overflow back then. I don't know if it's because I was a, you know, more junior as intermediate at this time. I'm not sure, but I think it's really tied to the platform because there's so many things that is related to those gigantesque frameworks and just the standard library in Java and .NET. It's crazy the amount of things that you need to know.
Yeah, it's true, yeah. Whereas with Go, like, I think it certainly feels a lot more modular. Like, you kind of pick things up as you go, and if you do come across issues, it's very easy to, like, you can even step through the source code and you can see how things work, and it just, yeah, it feels much easier. It doesn't, like you said, I don't know whether it's because I was more junior at the time, but I don't find myself going on Stack Overflow anywhere near as much as I used to now.
Yeah, I think we should maybe return to do some Java and .NET to see if we would go. That's not worth it. But, you know, joke aside, so today we will talk about, gRPC, in fact, a little bit. Well, not a little bit. It will be the main topic of this episode. So let's start by, you know, the obvious question, you know, what is gRPC in your words? And if someone was sleeping under a rock for the last, I don't know, 5-6 years, what are they missing?
Yeah, so gRPC is a modern open source framework, RPC framework written by Google. It uses HTTP/2 for transport and protocol buffers for interface definition language. And the main idea around it is it's language agnostic. So it makes it really easy to build polyglot services to communicate with one another, which makes it really ideal for kind of architectures where you have a lot of microservices talking to each other. And because it's built on HTTP/2, it has a lot of benefits over regular other frameworks like REST, for example, just because it has a lot of kind of performance improvements and with things like multiplexing, and also because it uses protocol buffer, it serializes data in binary format, which means messages are much smaller. So there's a lot of high performance features as well.
Yeah, totally. What would be your guide to, you know, if someone is agonizing, you know, if they should use gRPC over REST API? Let's say someone is very used to build, you know, standard JSON API like we are building for a long time now. But what would be a good rule of thumb, you think, to decide if gRPC is a good choice or if they might continue to use REST? Do you have a guideline for that?
Yeah, I think for me, like for kind of service to service communication within microservice architectures, I at least for synchronous communication, I would typically use gRPC. That's mainly due to its strong message structure. It's useful in architectures where you have a lot of very lightweight services communicating frequently. Because these contracts are kind of defined up front using protobuf, it makes communication type safe. And so it reduces any possibility of kind of mismatches or errors, which obviously you can build clients and you can kind of provide that functionality yourself with REST. But like this is kind of baked in out of the box with gRPC. And also because it's a language agnostic, like if you have a lot of different microservices and a lot of different languages, it really fits in well with that. It means you're not writing a lot of, you're not manually writing a lot of this code yourself. It's funny, like I actually have a very good story of kind of a situation where I wish we were using gRPC in the past. So it was actually a few years ago, a previous company I worked at. And the company I worked for at the time provided a digital wallet. So you can kind of think of it similar to Apple Pay or Google Pay. And at the time it was my first experience writing Go, first building microservices. I was only at the company for a few weeks, which made it a little more scary. and we had a lot of microservices communicating with one another, and they were using REST. And at the time we were manually creating these REST clients and then importing them into other services. So at the time I was working on it was a very simple ticket just to change a type from a string to a timestamp. So I made all the changes, got it all approved, ran it through our automation test framework, and all looked good. So I naively at this point assumed everything was fine. I deployed the change, moved on. And then next minute, we got a lot of reports from customer support saying that users' cards seemed to have been deleted from within the app. Oh. And that's when I realized that there was actually another microservice in between the one I'd worked on and the app. And it was making a REST call. I hadn't updated the client, and I just realized I'd introduced a breaking change into one of the APIs, and because of this, it was actually marking every user's card as deleted. So that was every single card for every single user.
Ouch!
So basically, at the time, if anyone had gone into the app, they would have thought their account had been wiped. So that was a very very
yeah,
stressful time, let's say. But yeah, I always think now, like if we were using gRPC at that moment, like I could have still done that change, and I could have still, you know, obviously broken, like we could have broken that contract there. But at least with protobuf, like when you're making that change, like you have to give it a bit more thought. And hopefully at that point, I would have realized what I was doing.
Oh yeah, totally. So yeah, that was one thing I wanted to touch base a little bit about breaking change. But I think you just probably nailed exactly what's the benefits of protobuf. Because I mean, in that particular situation, the service in the middle would have, you know, break, and now at least the data would have been maybe saved a little bit, or at least not flag as deleted like you described.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it would have, like we would have picked it up earlier because we would have seen a bunch of errors in the server, like in that integration in between the two services. Instead of the request was being successful, it's just that it was just the way it was unmarshaling the JSON response in the upstream service. It was kind of failing silently.
Oh yeah, that's always the worst. I mean,
yeah,
silent fail. But you know, while we are on this breaking change, thread and whatnot, I mean, How do you handle that? Because this thing still happens in gRPC. How are you handling putting something in production that you know will break other services? So what is your typical, you know, workflow and whatnot? Are you like contacting other teams and saying, well, you know, this contract will change now. This API is now, I don't know, returning something else, a different type, or accepting something new in the call of a function. How are you handling breaking change?
So typically breaking change should just be avoided at all costs. Like, there are obviously some kind of situations where they either can't be avoided, or if a gRPC service is not being used, then maybe breaking change is okay. But generally, we have a rule, at least at Cloudflare, that like wherever possible, we should just not make breaking changes at all. And kind of to enforce that, we actually have built like a protobuf registry that we use across all of our gRPC servers. So we have like a centralized repository that contains all the protobuf code. And in there, we have a lot of build tooling to kind of do different things like linting the protobuf and checking for breaking changes before then generating the code and publishing packages for various languages. So one thing we do in there is we check that any changes any schema changes don't contain breaking changes, and we do that by using a tool called buff, and buff is like a tool chain for protobuf, and it has a, you can run the CLI command to check for breaking changes, and if it will check things like if RPCs have been deleted or if data types have been changed, things like that. And if it will flag an error if that has happened. And the really nice thing about buff is you can run it as part of your CI pipeline. So we at Cloudflare, we do that when you make a change and you push the code and you create a PR, it will run these changes in CI. And if there are breaking changes in your code, it will actually fail the build. So we can block that PR from getting merged at that point. So it makes it almost impossible to actually deploy these breaking changes.
I like that a lot. So this tool, so it's not an internal tool that you build at Cloudflare, right? The buff CLI.
No, buff CLI is a publicly available tool.
That's interesting. So the fact that you have a centralized repository for your proto file ensure that, you know, something would just not build if there is a breaking change, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like we won't publish that protobuf won't get published or those changes unless there's no breaking changes.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Do you know if it's a common practice in bigger software companies that those protobuf those protofile would be, you know, would be centralized like that?
At least in my experience, like I've worked at two companies now where we've used gRPC, and in both companies we've had a kind of similar registry like this. I don't know if it's common practice, but I think it should be. I think protobuf can be very difficult to work with at scale, and I think like that's probably one benefit to using something like REST, where you don't really have to think about these things. But like at my previous company, I was there when we first adopted gRPC, and at the start we kind of didn't give this a lot of thought. And it became really, really became challenging to manage after we started building a few different services. Like we'd have bits of protobuf file in kind of different repos next to the service, and we'd be generating them just using like ad hoc protoc commands and generating the code using ad hoc protoc commands. And you kind of end up with protobuf in different versions. You'd end up not really knowing what APIs we have where, and it would just, like it just became kind of difficult to manage. Whereas like if you have all those schemas in one location and you're generating it with like standardized tooling, like at least you know you have much more repeatable builds, and it kind of acts as a form of documentation. Like it's very easy to discover what APIs you have if they're all listed in one central location.
Oh yeah, totally. So you're saying that before having it in a central repository, you were having some kind of distributed file all over the place, basically, right?
Exactly. Yeah, like we'd have, like it would be very. I think at the time, because we had a lot of microservices not using gRPC, it was very difficult to know which services were gRPC and which ones weren't. And if you didn't know the exact name of the service, it was really challenging to go and try and find it, and see exactly what APIs it provides.
And you mentioned something interesting that that kind of made me wonder. So you say that it's difficult to scale gRPC. So can you I mean extract that a little bit, elaborate what's your meaning by that?
So I mainly meant around scaling the usage of Protobuf more than scaling the service itself. But I think this is something that, at least when I first joined Cloudflare, we struggled with as well a little bit, is that at Cloudflare we use many different languages. I think we have about seven different languages that we use typically. Like Go is our primary language, but we have a lot of teams writing other things. And it was kind of the same there. Like when I first joined, we didn't have this kind of standardized registry for our gRPC protobuf. And we would have one team writing Go, and they would have a gRPC service with generated code in Go. We might have another team that's writing Rust, and they might want to use that Go service, but there's no Rust. The code's not been generated. There's no protobuf client in Rust because the first team just didn't think about generating it. And then, the problem I said about discovery with APIs, like that, as your company grows, that gets even more difficult. That was the biggest thing for us at Cloudflare, is once we moved to this kind of centralized repository, it meant out of the box, when someone creates a gRPC service, they automatically get their code generated in seven different languages besides just the one that they use every day. And it means that other engineers are not searching through different repos, searching through wiki docs and things like that to try and find what service they're looking for.
That totally. I can see how it could streamline the development process. This is interesting. Seven language at Cloudflare. Wow, this is impressive. I did not knew that. Do you have any exotic language in those? Any Haskell or any stranger language that we don't hear about too much, or it's basically just the good old Java and things like that.
So at Cloudflare, we're not very prescriptive on how teams work, really. So I think if teams wanted to use specific languages and they kind of have a good use case for it, then they're welcome to do so. So I'm sure we do have some kind of exotic languages, like you said, but I can't think of any examples off the top of my head, to be honest. But I think the primary languages we use are Go. I would say we use Go for the vast majority of our services. But then we also have an awful lot of Rust as well. And then we use quite a lot of NPM, so a lot of Node and TypeScript, that sort of stuff.
The inevitable, I would say. And what about clients for those JavaScript client in gRPC? Do you have anything to say about that? Is it like smooth? Because I think you need a plugin or something like that to generate some kind of client side JavaScript.
So I think when you generate the code using Proto-C, like for each language you generate for, you kind of need their own language specific plugins. I think for the Node ecosystem in general, or the NPM ecosystem in general, there's two types. There's kind of the Node bindings, and then there's the gRPC web bindings as well, and that's more for client-side JavaScript. Truthfully, at Cloudflare, we don't use gRPC externally. We kind of only use it for our internal service-to-service communication, so we don't actually use gRPC web, but we do use it kind of on the back end. But that's another thing, another advantage do we get from our centralized repository? That basically, like, we like one thing that I've seen problems I've seen in the past is that whenever an engineer wants to generate code in multiple languages, they kind of have to have all these Proto-C plugins installed on their machine. So, if we've got a lot of languages out there, like, you might need a Python plugin that's installed by pip. You might need a Node plugin installed by NPM, like the Rust one by Cargo, the Go one installed from Go install. And that gets pretty challenging, like, if, especially for an engineer who's not really familiar with the other ecosystems, like, it gets kind of challenging and probably gets quite frustrating to have to install all those things if you don't have them already. But that's one nice thing we get with Buff is Buff has its own schema registry, which kind of acts as like a package manager for Protobuf. And with Buff, you can kind of define this list of plugins in a config file. And then you can just run like the Buff generate command, and that will like pull those plugins from their schema registry and generate the code in every language that you need out of the box. So it makes it super, super simple to do that.
I like that a lot, I must admit. While this seems to be very clean the way that it is handled. Have you seen any issues with the code generation? You know, the code that is generated by Proto-C. I mean, do you have any kind of story? Because, you know, I mean, code generation is still, you know, sometimes it's not the best one. So do you have any issues or I mean, it's all good and well from your side?
Truthfully, I haven't seen any major issues with the generated code. I have to say, I think GRPC support for Go is much stronger than it is for a lot of the other languages. I think partially because it was written by Google, probably primarily for Go. So I think it can be challenging to find the right plugins for certain languages. This is something I've experienced with TypeScript in the past, where like there's a lot of different kind of third-party plugins, not official ones, for generating the code. And that, like with JavaScript and TypeScript in general, there's always a lot of different ways to do something. So I found it a challenge before making sure you find the right kind of plugins for the project you're working on to make sure you generate the code in the right way, or like making sure you provide the right kind of advice on how to use the protobuf that's generated. But yeah, besides that, I can't think of any specific issues I've seen with the generated code itself.
Yeah, that's good news then. I mean, you know, if it's Cloudflare, I don't know, compliant, if we can say that, it should be fine for a lot of us, I would say. So what about HTTP2? I know we've talked a little bit about that, but I mean, can you tell us a little bit about if you ever use the maybe the bidirectional way of communicating? So let's say you have a client. Let's say you have a client that talks to a service or two or multiple services that, I don't know, need to be in kind of real time communication. Do you use that a little bit at Cloudflare?
To be honest, at Cloudflare we don't typically use it a lot. I think that's largely just due to the architecture that we have. Like at Cloudflare, we have an event based architecture which is backed by Kafka mainly, so any kind of event streaming type workloads go handled by that. But I think I can definitely see the value of it as at the same time. One use case I did use at a previous company was just as a replacement for polling. Essentially, we had an API that basically made a request to initiate a process that was kind of kicked off a bunch of downstream processing. So instead of the mobile app polling our API, we used server streaming to stream updates until the process was successful. Now, that worked pretty well, but I have to say, it was probably overkill for our use case. I think polling would have been more simpler, and we wouldn't have had to worry about the kind of the failure mode so much, like if the connection drops and things like that. But at the same time, I can see how the like HTTP2 features are kind of really useful for situations where real-time communication is key. Like good examples of this would be like gaming servers or financial tickers, because you can like, because these connections are long-lived and you like can stream data directly to the client, I think. And also because it's binary encoded, so the payloads are typically much smaller than kind of text-based formats like JSON. Like the performance is just much quicker than you'll get with something like REST.
Yeah, totally. So you would say something like, you know, it depends and could be interesting, but you recognize that the complexity, it adds a little bit complexity, I would say, probably.
Yeah, definitely. I think I think polling is always going to be simpler, just because if you're polling an endpoint and it fails, you know you're going to call it again next time. Whereas with this, like if the connection drops, you kind of have to handle all that retry logic and things like that, and handle error scenarios that you just wouldn't get otherwise.
Yeah, totally. What about? I mean, it's all good. It's all good. We've built some services that use gRPC. We have some clients. What about? I mean, the famous authorization and whatnot. I mean, what are you using internally? So because you're saying that you're mainly using the services internally. So I'm curious to see a little bit about the authentication.
Yeah, so I think we've handled this in a few different ways, because we have like our services are primarily running inside a Kubernetes cluster, and they're not exposed to the outside world at all. We're kind of quite safe in that we know that the traffic is going to be coming from an internal service. So in some cases, we don't have to worry so much about SSL or TLS, things like that. We can just kind of handle plain text communication, and that's fine. However, we have some services where we require the data to be sent encrypted in transit. So in those cases, we use mutual TLS for that, which Go has good support for. So in that case, you provide a certain key from the server side, and you provide one from the client, and they both validate each other to make sure that, you know, we only allow certain clients to talk to our services. But also we can restrict that, at least inside a Kubernetes cluster, we can restrict which services can talk to our gRPC service using network policies as well, to just ensure that we're happy that only certain clients can communicate. But in terms of authorization as well, like I've seen like different approaches to this as well. So like some services, we're kind of happy to not have any additional authorization logic. Like we're happy if that connection can be made, then, you know, we don't need to validate like a token or anything like that. However, like if a service is exposed publicly, like hypothetically, or if we do want more granular authorization on our service, like gRPC does support middleware. So, which is kind of similar to HTTP headers. It allows you to kind of pass custom. Sorry, it does support metadata, not middleware, which kind of acts as HTTP headers. And it does also support middleware. So you can basically create custom logic that runs on each request before it hits the main gRPC service, but like the server code. So in that case, it's kind of possible to send a token in the middleware, in the header, and then in the middleware, we can kind of pass that and extract the claims and make sure that the token is authorized to do the operation.
Nice. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So let me throw at you a small real world situation. I have built an open source a Go project. It's basically a backend server API that is kind of similar to in a very very lightweight way to what Firebase is. So basically it's like an easy database, user management, file storage and whatnot. I mean, basic building blocks that most web applications need. And I built that with a REST approach, if you will. My question is, how would you approach maybe not rewriting, but I mean just transitioning from a REST API to a more gRPC approach? Is it even a good idea to do that? Have you seen services that do handle both in a certain transition? I don't know. You know, have you had to migrate such a service?
Yeah, I have done it in the past. I would say, unless there's a specific need, like unless the service is causing problems, or if you feel the need to have like kind of tight, very strong schema and type safe communication, or maybe you need to take advantage of the HTTP2 functionality. I think if it's not for those reasons, I probably wouldn't migrate. I think like REST is perfectly acceptable, and like I think it would be fine to leave as it is. But yeah, like I have seen this done, like these migrations done, and like there's kind of two approaches I would take to this. I would create the protobuf and the definition and the service and all that. And then like when it comes to actually doing the migration, you could either spin up the gRPC service inside the same deployable, inside the same executable by running it in a separate goroutine and listening on a separate port. And I think that would work fine. That's how my previous company did it. We kind of just, if we wanted to run both in parallel, like we actually has example services where we might want it to expose a REST API directly to the mobile app. So we'd create a HTTP server on port 8080, but then also we might want like a gRPC internal server to communicate with our other services, and then we'd open a port on 50051, which is the standard port for gRPC. So in those cases, we kind of have both servers running on separate goroutines inside the same deployable. But if you wanted to kind of separate them a bit more and just make sure that they can both scale independently without causing problems for one another, then you could easily just create kind of a separate main file and separate deployable for the gRPC server instead of running it in the same
program. Service. Yeah, I like that idea a lot. So yeah, it's not really a something that I want to do. It's something that opened an issue, and I was like, that's interesting. I mean, I never really thought about building the gRPC way for this type of application. But now, you know, the issue is created, and now you start to think, well, maybe there's something there. But I mean, I'm with you as well. if a system is working, I mean, there's not much. But it's, you know, I mean, it's not something in production. It's not even something that is running anywhere meaningful. I would guess.
Yeah, and one thing I would say is like if this is an API that customers are directly communicating with, I would, and it like a public API and not one that's just being called from a system, another client that you're running yourself, then like, I typically wouldn't use gRPC. I wouldn't do a migration for something like that, just because I think REST is generally easier to communicate with.
Yeah, I hear you. So basically what you're saying is it like, so gRPC is really good for internal communication of your services, but as soon as you go, you know, in a public API, you know, REST could probably still be the best choice here?
Yeah, I think so. I think like, although I don't think it's a large learning curve, I think there is a learning curve with gRPC that you don't typically have when writing like HTTP APIs. I think like obviously like everyone, like customers would have to be familiar with protobuf and how that works and creating clients and all that stuff. Whereas with REST, you can kind of just do a curl command and get a response. And yeah, I think typically a lot more people are just familiar with REST in general. So it's much easier to push adoption, especially to customers with things like that.
Right. Yeah. Totally. So that's very interesting. So do you have any kind of, I don't know, horror story or downside of something that you've seen that, you know, gRPC really, I don't know, did not really made sense, or that it you know, it make you or, you know, makes the team a little bit more less productive or things like that? I mean, is it always smooth?
I would say some of the tooling around gRPC is kind of a little bit immature, and I think for that reason it kind of does make it a little challenging to work locally with and like interact locally with. Although I think it has got a lot better over the past couple of years, but I think it can be challenging from that aspect. Like, for example, things like Postman, they've kind of only recently started to support gRPC. So I think like debugging and interacting with an API is just not quite as easy with gRPC as other frameworks. Like, I remember when we first started using it at my previous company, like, we kind of just didn't have any good way to interact and test things, which was not ideal. And we'd have little kind of scripts that people would write and like little commands just to kind of like just to hit an endpoint, which is not ideal. And the other thing is, like, with gRPC, you kind of like, you need to provide the profiles to actually do that testing and actually, like hit an API. Either that, or you could use server reflection, which probably don't want, which server reflection is a way to kind of expose information about the APIs that are available on the server externally. And that's probably not something you'd want to have enabled on a production server. I think the tooling has got much better, but I think that's kind of the pain points I've seen, at least with gRPC in the past.
Yeah, what you just said reminds me a little bit of those old, SOAP services back then, the XML SOAP services. I don't know if you had some experience with that, but yes, there was like this public portal, and people could, it was acting like a documentation as well. I mean, in a sense, gRPC is a little bit like that, but it's just, I mean, it's just, you know, better design, I would say, because I mean, SOAP was kind of extremely verbose, but I mean, at the end of the day, an RPC is an RPC, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think that, yeah, like the biggest difference is just that SOAP is XML, gRPC is protobuf.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, do you have any closing thought about gRPC? Do you have I don't know, resources that you want to talk about before we close this episode?
So I think for anyone who is using gRPC at their company or looking to adopt it, I certainly would look at, like, obviously you want to build fast and, you know, not build a lot of like pre-optimized, but I think it is definitely worth giving some thought to how protobuf is managed, and not just rushing in and building things, because it can be very hard to go back and undo those things. Like if you have protobuf all over the place, it can be very difficult to then go back and migrate that to a kind of centralized repository. So I would definitely like recommend thinking about building something like that to start out with. Like it maybe doesn't need all the tooling around it, but potentially we have at Cloudflare, but like, you know, just having somewhere with all the protobuf in one place, I think definitely makes sense. It's something I actually have created like a sample repository for this in the past, just for a different project I was working on. So I can share a link to that as well. But I would also like encourage people to check out Buff. I think it definitely makes working with protobuf a lot easier as well. Just generating code in different languages and having to deal with the proto-c command is not always the easiest, especially if you're very new to this stuff. So I would definitely recommend checking out Buff, because it definitely makes things a lot easier.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, we will have this link on the show note for sure. Maybe just one last question about those breaking change. You're saying that you try to not introduce any breaking change, but does that cause you having a lot of versioning here and there all over the place? You know, if something needs to change, I mean, the only way is probably to create a new I don't know, a new function for that, or at least a new maybe not a new endpoint, but either a new version for that thing, or rename that for some services. And now you have, you know, I don't know, a group of services that is using function A and another one that is using function B. Is that the situation?
So it's not typically a problem we've faced a lot. But yeah, like that definitely can happen. I think if like just changing a field name, it's quite simple. Changing a field type is quite simple. You can mark the old field as deprecated. So we do definitely have some kind of protocol of contracts where we have a lot of deprecated fields, and it looks kind of messy. But I think it makes sense to avoid making that breaking change, because if you do that, then you suddenly have to start kind of coordinating releases to make sure that you're deploying clients and servers at the same time, and then that still makes it impossible to make sure you don't end up with any errors at all. But at the same time, like it's worth noting that like breaking changes are not like strictly forbidden. Like we do make exceptions to these to allow certain changes to be merged in certain circumstances. Like for example, if we know like that protobuf contract is not being used, or if we know it's not going to cause a problem, like by making that breaking change, like we will merge that and make that change. Obviously, it's not like strict best practice, but I think like it's best to be pragmatic in these cases, and it's better to keep the protobuf as tidy as possible in cases where like really the breaking change won't make that much difference.
Yeah, totally. I hear you on that. That's very interesting. I mean, it's the second guest that we have on Cloudflare, and I mean, I'm learning a little bit more and more, and this company seems to be very interesting to me. Cool. That was great. I mean, let's close the show. I tried to have a one question, the last question that I'm asking guests. Are you missing anything in Go? Is there anything that you are missing from, I don't know, maybe Java? You were talking about Java at first. Maybe it's that. You know, is there anything that you would like, you know, to have in Go that is not present at the moment?
As much as I would like to say, no, I think Go is perfect. There's definitely nothing. But no, I think it's funny. Like, I actually... I'm still like, the more I write Go, the more I realize how great it is as a language. But I do a lot of times miss a lot of features that you get from languages like Java, because I think Go tries to be as simple as possible and as idiomatic as possible, and I think that's a really great thing, and that has definitely really helped me in the past, keeping code bases clean and as they grow. But but there are times where you think like just things like the lambda functions in Java and like the functional API. Like, I think it would be like, I really like that in Java, and I think it can be really powerful. I think one feature I really like, it's kind of syntactical sugar, but one thing I really like in Kotlin is the extension functions. So that's kind of a way of extending existing classes with new functionality without using inheritance. So essentially, you can define a function on a pre-existing type, and it acts like it was originally a part of the original API. So I kind of like that, because it makes it very easy to make code easy to read and maintain, and you're allowed to add methods that are specific to your needs. And it looks like it's a part of the original code. So trying to think of a good example of something like this. Like, let's say you have a string that's a password. You could add a function to the string data type that would say is password, and it would kind of validate that it's a password, something like that. Like, it's kind of syntactical sugar because you could just create that function and pass a string into it. But yeah, I think it's quite a nice function, a functionality they have in Kotlin.
Yeah, sure. I think if you were to alias the string type in Go, you could create a function that received this type, and now, but I hear you. It would not be attached to the, you know, the primitive string of Go for sure.
Yeah. I have thought about doing that before because it's kind of similar, but I don't know. I don't like the idea of having to do kind of unnecessary casting and things like that.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I must admit that. Yeah, I also miss sometimes the lambda in C sharp as well, which is probably similar to Java's. But for me, it's really, I keep saying that in this podcast. But yeah, I will continue to say it. The data manipulation, you know, all the database, and I'm not a fan of ORM. Don't get me wrong here, but still, I mean, I haven't found something that I'm really in love with to manipulate data. I'm talking about SQL. I mean, SQL database. Database SQL as a package is great. Don't get me wrong as well, but I mean, it's either too verbose, or I don't really like what I have as options to talk to databases.
Yeah, I would totally agree as well. And I think I've never really found a good ORM with Go, whereas at least with Java, like, it was, I never had that problem. Like, any ORM that I used, I seemed to really enjoy, and I thought it was very easy to interact with, whereas in Go, I've never found a good one.
Yeah, maybe sometimes, but all right. So Chris, thank you very much. It was very interesting, and I mean, we will have a couple of links in the show notes, and again, I mean, thank you so much for accepting the offer.
Oh yeah, thanks a lot for having me. It's been great.